rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Die Central European University ist eine der führenden privaten Universitäten des Kontinents, begründet mit Unterstützung des Milliardärs und Philanthropen George Soros. Ist die CEU ein Ort der offenen Auseinandersetzung für liberale Demokratien? Von Viktor Orban wurde die Central European University aus Budapest vertrieben. Jetzt hat sie in Wien ihr Standbein. Studierende aus aller Welt nach Wien zu bringen, das ist viel mühsamer, als es in Budapest je war, berichten erstaunt die Universitätsverantwortlichen. Die für Fremdenrecht zuständige Wiener Magistratsabteilung 35 macht vielen das Leben schwer. Aber die akademischen Freiheiten, die es in Österreich gibt, sind ein großer Gewinn. Zu den Aufgaben der Central European University gehört die Auseinandersetzung mit kritischen Geistern aus aller Welt, auch aus den USA. Ihr Moderator durfte an der CEU für die Studierenden online ein Interview mit dem Soziologen Fred Block in Kalifornien führen über die aktuelle gesellschaftliche und politische Situation in den Vereinigten Staaten. Hören Sie selbst, was wir online unter dem Übertitel US Capitalism Between Trump, Biden und Bernie Sanders mit dem kalifornischen Soziologen Fred Block diskutiert haben.
Welcome everybody. It's an honor for me to be part of this talk at Central European University. The title we decided on, you heard it already, American Capitalism, choosing between Trump, Biden and Bernie Sanders, the former president, the actual president and the senator from Vermont who describes himself as a democratic socialist. I think it's an appropriate topic at a very appropriate time, because worldwide we are in a time of many upheavals happening at the same time, and many of them coming from America. Obviously, the political upheaval that American democracy has seen, where American democracy nearly collapsed with the onslaught of the former president against the democratic, liberal democratic system, something certainly unthinkable quite a time ago. Attacks not coming from a foreign enemy, not coming from extremists, but from the White House. And we all know there are many Trumps worldwide, because America is leading power. America's political system taught many others that democracy must be pluralistic, must include opposition, and must embrace, in certain situations, civil disobedience. Upheavals not only in the political area, but also in the economic area, with the international financial system close to collapse 10 years ago, a system again dominated by American financial capitalism. welcome, how all that is linked together, how to interpret the interdependence of all these areas. There is nobody more qualified than the scholar we are talking to today. Welcome with me from California, Fred Block. Hello.
Hello.
Professor Block, where are you physically? Because we also exist physically and not only in cyberspace.
I'm in the third floor study of my house in Berkeley, California.
And universities in California are open. They work half real time, half analog. How does it function?
They've mostly been operating in person. In Northern California, the pandemic is largely under control. They have extensive surveillance regimes. I'm not sure about Southern California. It's I think starting to have some resurgence of the virus.
The pandemic, it doesn't seem to be over. Also in California, and certainly not in Austria and in Europe. Fred Block is professor of sociology at the University of California in Davis, the Californian city of Davis, a little bit an hour's drive from San Francisco. Professor Block, through his work, his career in the academic field and his many publications, has become known as someone who is very critical towards mainstream economists and other mainstream thinkers in social sciences, and helped others to base their criticism on theory. His latest book is called Capitalism, the Future of an Illusion, and we'll talk a little bit about this book. That was mentioned before, I would like to mention it again. Fred Block is active since many years in the Karl Polanyi Institute of Political Economy. Karl Polanyi, of course, having been an economist in the first half of the 20th century, who positioned himself against the Austrian school of liberal economics without being a Marxist, without being a communist, so a tradition that Fred Block himself has been very much very interested in. Let me start, Fred, with the news of the week. President Biden has signed a big investment package for the United States. It's hailed as one of the biggest packages of this kind in American history. Is this really that big? And how, in general, do you see the economics of the Biden administration?
Well, that the infrastructure package, the first one that's been signed, is a moderately big deal. It is a kind of continuation of the spending on transportation infrastructure that's been reauthorized on a fairly regular basis. It's on a larger scale than that, and it does go beyond surface transportation to include funding for broadband, you know, particularly for rural areas, and it has funding for clean water in a number of places. As you know, the pipes haven't been replaced, and they're lead, and there's been issues of lead poisoning for children. So it is a substantial effort, but basically what happened was that Biden had put forward a broad plan that included this spending on physical infrastructure, but also addressed the huge deficits in the care economy in the U.S., that we have no federal system of paid family leave, that there's been no federal money going into child care to subsidize child care. And that so Biden initially put together this very bold package that included both this spending on infrastructure, the traditional infrastructure. It included the social spending, the child care, the child tax credits.
And it was compared to the New Deal by FDR or the war on poverty by Johnson. So the plans were pretty ambitious.
Right. And they also...
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
That initial plan also included the very substantial investments in addressing climate change, in moving towards electrification of transportation, and significant moves to push utilities to shift out of coal, natural gas, towards.
So it's as far as plans is concerned, it's a big change, isn't it?
It's a very big change. But so what happened as the legislative sausage making proceeded was that the plan got divided up in a somewhat peculiar way, in that more centrist Democrats wanted Republican buy-in. And so there was a long process of negotiation. And so much of the physical infrastructure investment was hived off into a separate bill. This is the one that was signed today. And it had strong bipartisan support in the U.S. Senate, which, as you know, is now extremely unusual given the polarized nature of American politics. But I think fully 19 Republican senators voted for it. So what this created was a tension that the idea was that this was all that Republicans would support. And so the other elements, the social spending and much of the clean energy initiative was hived off into a separate bill that was initially supposed to be something like $3.5 trillion over the next 10 years. And that there's very complicated congressional politics where the kind of usual process of bold plans being shrunk down to almost to something that wasn't bold at all didn't quite happen. But the passage...
It still could happen.
It still could happen. So the passage of the second bill, that started at $3.5 trillion and has now been pared down to 1.8 trillion or something like that. That piece of legislation is still hanging. It's going to be voted in the U.S. House of Representatives. It's expected to pass in the House before Thanksgiving. And then the big question, the huge question of American politics, is whether it will be able to get the support of every Democratic senator. So it requires all 50 of them to vote for it, and then it would be a tie.
But it is still, it means that the leadership of the Democratic Party is on a course of government intervention, on a course of change compared to the economic policy of the previous years, that could be rightly compared to, as mentioned before, Roosevelt, Johnson war on poverty. I mean, for the leadership of the Democratic Party, this is a big, big, makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. That if the second piece of legislation passes, you're absolutely right. This will be the collective spending of these two bills and the last COVID response bill will exceed what was done under Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society, and it will be on the scale of the change that came in the New Deal. And the critical point to emphasize is that this comes after literally 50 years in which there have been no domestic measures that expanded governmental capacity, with the sole exception of Obamacare that came in 2010. But on the scale, the range of different things being funded, it does represent a kind of dramatic turn away from the market liberalism, the neoliberalism that's dominated American politics for 40 years.
Absolutely fascinating, a fascinating development. Let me, Fred Block, expand it and go into a little bit more general level, because this is not limited to America. We have also in Europe huge government financial government programs now in the framework of the pandemic. Do you think, in general, that we witness a comeback of government after decades of neoliberalism, where the state was supposed to get out of the economy?
Well, absolutely, but with the caveat that we're still kind of not out of the woods with the return of the authoritarian right. I mean, in other words, that part of the reason that the Democratic Party has taken this left turn is that they went through a near-death experience, the near-death of American democracy. And there was a recognition by the Democratic Party leadership that the only way to break the dynamic that was pushing the Republican Party further to the right and further in the authoritarian populist direction was to address the kind of deep economic and social needs of the society. But it's a big gamble as to whether first, whether all of the legislation will get through, and second, whether it will have the intended impact of changing the political facts on the ground.
Near death of American democracy, that's a very strong characterization of what has happened. Of course, Trumpism was defeated a year ago, defeated at the election, then defeated on January 6th, where his fans tried to attack the Capitol. But Trumpism is not over. So it still dominates the conservative side of the political spectrum. I want to ask you first, how do you characterize Trumpism? Is that fascism of our time, anti-democratic, leadership-oriented, xenophobic, and having a certain mass movement?
Yeah, I mean, I find the fascism debate kind of pointless. I mean, that it's true that Trumpism didn't have people organized in a special color of shirt, you know, who were organized in paramilitary bands. But de facto, the result was the same, because the self-organized far right, the various militias and the Proud Boys and a number of paramilitary groups had organized themselves. And what we saw on January 6th was a very, very deliberate effort organized, by the White House to essentially use the mob taking over the Capitol as the basis for stopping the Congress from approving the the electoral vote, to approving the Biden victory. And what's come out in the last few weeks is that this was very sophisticated. I mean, that they had developed plans in the White House justifications, and it stood on a knife's edge, because what they were trying to do was to get Mike Pence, the vice president, to say, there's so much controversy about the results out of Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, where the results were close and there have been all kinds of claims of fraud, that we're going to, you know, send demand from those state legislatures that they look into the election and maybe send us a new set of electors. And if that had happened, the way that the rules are written, the election would have been thrown to the House of Representatives, where this arcane rule, which hasn't been used in a very long time, is that each of the 50 state delegations has one vote. And at the time, the Republicans controlled 27 of those delegations. And so the House of Representatives, had it been thrown to them, could have said, well, there's enough ambiguity in the election that we're going to return Trump to office and disregard what actually happened in the vote.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
It was a kind of a coup attempt within, in a certain level, in the framework of the Constitution and the framework of the system. And that's something we witness in Europe. I mean, there are many Trumps in the world, mini Trumps in the world, and the authoritarian trends that we see in European countries too, also out of Europe, is not through a coup d'etat from outside, but from inside, an authoritarian change of the system. Now, what is surprising, also worrying, is that the Trump people, far-right extremists, in as far as their political characterization is concerned, still control the Republican Party, which is not a small party. This is the big traditional party of American conservatives, which makes the confrontation that you describe something that probably is going to go on. So why do these Trump extremists maintain their control over the Republican Party, half of the Senate, a big part of the Congress, and they could win the next elections in 1 year's time? Why can they maintain their control?
Well, I mean, the core is that this deep polarization exists, and that millions and millions of people live in a different epistemic community. They get their news from Fox News or from other right-wing outlets or from social media. And it's totally shaped their view of reality. And this group, which maybe it's only 25% or 22% of the population, is a group that's large enough to win Republican primaries in most states. So the establishment Republicans are living in continuous terror of the Trump base, of this 22 or 23% that believe Trump's vision of reality. And, you know, one of the places that we see this is around the pandemic. I mean, these are the people who are refusing to wear masks in states like Florida and Texas. The governors have said that that localities, public schools cannot mandate mask wearing. Similarly, there's been tremendous resistance to vaccination and an alternative medical regime where there's a particular medicine that's sometimes used for people, but is more commonly used for horses to...
We know about that in Austria, pretty much.
Okay, so you're familiar with the ivermectin problem. So there are people filling themselves up with these drugs that have no actual relationship to the pandemic. And so, you know, my point is that if people in the face of a deadly pandemic are willing to believe false information about that the vaccine will hurt them and that ivermectin will help them, certainly that, you know, it's much easier to believe that Trump is the savior and must be returned to office and the election was stolen from him. And then they're willing to impose that belief on the Republicans in Congress.
So the confrontation and the fight for American democracy is not over, but it's not, it does not automatically lead to defeat. That's also there's no reason for defeatism if you look at the big changes that happened in the last year in the United States. And 2020 was, of course, not only the time of the end of the Trump presidency, but also the time of one of the biggest social movements in American history, the Black Lives Matter movement after the murder of George Floyd by police. And that's a mass movement that was instrumental to change the political atmosphere in the U.S. and helped, of course, to stop Trump. I would like, Fred Block, to talk to you about your personal formation, your personal experience, because your personal upbringing, politicization, happened in the 60s, in the time of the anti-war movement against the Vietnam War. You participated in the big march in D.C. against the Vietnam War, 65. Let me ask you how did you feel? How what kind of experience was that for you? Describe a little bit, because many of our viewers will be very interested to hear from somebody who has been there at an event they only know about from history books.
Yeah, no, I feel somewhat like an antique at this point, kind of one of the living survivors of the of the new left of the 1960s. But let me emphasize that I came from a liberal middle class family and radicalized in response to the civil rights movement on the one side and the Vietnam War on the other. And one of the kind of critical moments in my political formation was in 1964, I was, I guess, 17, but that the civil rights movement in Mississippi, which was, a plantation economy relatively unchanged from the late 19th century and extremely systematic racial exclusion. And when Black people began to attempt to register to vote, the response was violence and extrajudicial killings. And in the summer of 64, three Northern civil rights workers who had gone to Mississippi were killed and, you know, buried in a dam. Out of the mobilization, there was a challenge by the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party of the mainline Democratic Party, which was a segregationist party that excluded Black people and pursued a reactionary political agenda. And so at the Democratic National Convention in 64, where Lyndon Johnson's reelection was being managed, there was a challenge to the segregationist Democratic Party. And by this slate of an integrated slate of Black and white people who represented the possibility of an integrated, desegregated Mississippi. And essentially, the forces of political compromise I think allowed some token representation of the Mississippi Freedom Democrats, and the segregationist Democrats were allowed to be seated. And it was a moment of recognition of the degree to which the existing political system was endorsing and partaking in in the continuation of racial apartheid in parts of the country. I'm going into this precisely, you know, because you raised the George Floyd moment, and that what's important to emphasize is that all the issues that were raised in this moment of racial reckoning, the police violence against Black people, systematic segregation in housing, various forms of political exclusion. All of these issues were raised in the 1960s. There was a moment at which it appeared that the society was moving towards racial justice, but that progress was halted in the Nixon administration, and then much of it reversed as the market fundamentalist turn happened. And so instead of significant progress of moving towards racial equality, we got a kind of consolidation of an unjust racial order.
But the civil rights movement, the American civil rights movement, was a powerful example for the rest of the world, for us in Europe, on the theme civil disobedience can be an accepted way of expression in one's opinion, can be an accepted way of waking up authoritarian system. That was the example of the civil rights movement that made Rudi Dutschke in Berlin organize teach-ins and sit-ins, and also in Vienna. I mean, there had been, a movement of solidarity with Vietnam, which all the time was a solidarity with the American anti-war movement. What was the atmosphere? Can you describe a little bit at this big demonstration, 65 in DC? Young people thought, okay, we are in the heart of the belly of imperialism. That was the phraseology that was used at that time, and we are changing the system now. How did you feel that atmosphere?
Oh, that it was, you know, extraordinarily exhilarating. And in the movement against the Vietnam War, I mean, so just autobiographically, I started college in 64 and finished graduate school in 74. And basically, that 10 years kind of coincided with the struggle against the Vietnam War, and that across the whole, up until around 72 or something like that, that the anti-war movement kept getting stronger. It got deeper support from the public. The war became less and less popular. And we had the feeling of being on the cusp of a social movement, which was on the verge of making spectacular changes. And so that revolution was in the air, and we fooled ourselves into believing that a radical transformation of the society was possible and just lay a little bit beyond the horizon. And of course, in the early 70s, the movement reached its limits. It was contained. It was that the U.S. did leave Vietnam, but the project of domestic reform and transformation was brought to a halt by the consolidation of a more conservative regime, the public backlash against the movements of the 60s fueled the rise of the new right. And, by the end of the 70s, we had Reagan and the beginning of market liberalism. And so,
of course, but you also had Barack Obama. You had Reagan, but also you had Barack Obama. But even the 60s changed America. They didn't. The activists of the 60s didn't take power. One might say that's not such a bad thing, because we don't know what they would have done if they would have taken power. But anyway, they changed American society. American society now is less conservative, less, more inclusive, more open than before all these movements. And Barack Obama was the symbol, of course, of all these changes. But you mentioned the conservative backlash. That came, of course. If you look at California today, the California universities in California, what's left of the leftist tradition, and how strong does one feel the consequences of the conservative backlash that happened afterwards?
Well, I think the main way in which the conservative backlash has been felt is that in response to the movements of the 60s, California developed what was called the Master Plan for Higher Education, which involved a kind of three-tier educational structure with the University of California at the top. And then there was a state college system and then community colleges. And the idea was that this was all publicly funded and represented a kind of American version of social democracy, in which the educational level of the population would be significantly increased. And this has worked. I mean, the reason that Silicon Valley happened in California had to do with the higher level of scientific and technical education in the population, so that the labor force that Silicon Valley required was available. But one of the things which happened during the conservative backlash was that the public funding diminished. And so when one gets up to the present, the University of California, the demography of the student body is pretty similar to the demography of those people who go to elite private universities elsewhere, that the upper middle class dominates, that higher education as a route to social mobility, the promise of that has been much less because of the tuition barriers, the high fees, and so forth. So on that side, progress was limited and restricted. But in terms of the content of higher education, you're right that the spirit of the 60s has meant that ethnic studies, gender studies, a more progressive vision of the world has been built into the curriculum. And so that's part of why California has continued to be one of the more progressive, more leftist states, you know, diverging from the rest of the country. So you're absolutely right to emphasize the way in which the legacy of the movement of the 60s did change. I mean, so in a sense, we can understand the polarization of the current moment in that the long march through the institutions, you know, did change the culture, change the society, create a larger population of people who recognize that government could even the playing field could expand its role. But at the same time, the legacy of the right, you know, is still extremely powerful and, you know, is has taken this regrettable turn from kind of Reaganite free market to Trumpian aggressive.
And I see Karsten here coming up with some questions from social media, if I'm right.
That's correct. And there are two questions that are related and address one, the location of the Republican Party, and the other, the location of the Democratic Party, but not on a spectrum on whether one is fascist and the other is socialist, but more specifically to the Republican Party, the question is, how would you situate the current Republican Party in the sort of the triangle between the working class, small business, and large business? So what is their location there? And for the Democratic Party, the point of entry for this question is that we have been talking now about the noisy coups of the Trump and mini Trumps. But what about the influence, so to speak, of financial institutions and the way in which their lobby capacity endangers democracy? And that is a question about the Democratic Party in the sense that how much is it already captured, maybe even beyond remedy, by this interest group, and whether or not the Biden presidency is changing something in this regard.
There's a good questions, complicated questions. So the kind of question of big business, corporate power, and electoral politics is pretty complicated. I mean, that essentially kind of we have a history where big business has, you know, been supportive of, overwhelmingly supportive of the Republican Party, that some kind of, some special sectors of business, like a part of Wall Street, have been supportive of the Democratic Party. But everything is kind of in a weird kind of flux at the moment. And essentially the Trumpian turn has created a rift between big business, mainline corporations, and the Republican Party. And that was part of the story of that bipartisan support for the infrastructure bill, was that Trump made it clear the other day that the 13 Republicans in the House of Representatives who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill were criminals who needed to be driven out of the Republican Party. But in the United States Senate, as I said before, 19 Republican senators voted for this legislation. And that was essentially a reflection of the continuing power of big business within the Republican coalition. They need the infrastructure spending. That if you're the automobile industry, the roads and bridges going into disrepair is, a disaster. I mean, that many of the businesses are heavily, are going to benefit from this infrastructure spending. So it's a very complicated terrain where in some significant ways, the Democratic Party is seeking to create some kind of realignment where broader sections of business that had never before supported the Democratic coalition would come over to the Democrats. What makes it particularly complicated is the monopoly issue. I mean, and the monopoly issue shows up in a number of sectors. It shows up in pharmaceuticals, which are, dominated by a handful of giant pharmaceutical firms. It shows up in Wall Street with the dominance of a handful of giant banks and the firms like Fidelity and BlackRock that control vast sectors of the economy. And it shows up, of course, with the tech firms, the Apples and Facebook and Google and Microsoft. So the Biden administration has signaled a very strong interest in challenging monopoly power, in breaking up or devising forms of regulation that would open up some of these markets and challenge the entrenched power of finance. And so it's a very complicated political game, which is going on where, firms like Facebook that have enormous resources and enormous influence are running TV ads saying we need the government to regulate us so that we won't have to make these kind of difficult decisions about censoring content, all on our own. But they don't really want anybody to interfere with their monopoly power and their money-making machine. And they're playing that while they have historically been more allied with the Democratic Party than the other way around, they have also been playing footsie with the Republicans, with the far right. And so all of this is part of the kind of the drama of this particular moment of polarization. I guess I didn't address the other parts of that question. So let's say that the white non-college educated population is the kind of central battleground of politics. The Biden spending programs are designed essentially to win that demographic back to the Democratic Party. But that their defection from the Democratic Party, their movement towards the Republicans has been a critical part of the Trumpist success. So that's kind of where the fight is. And that's why the racial issue continues to be at the center of American politics, because the way in which the right seeks to win the support of non-college educated white people is through racial resentment. So you saw in the recent gubernatorial election in Virginia that the campaign centered about around the teaching of critical race theory. And critical race theory isn't actually taught in public schools, but that the Republican campaign pretended it was. And that so as, you know, as from 1619 onward, the issue of race and racial polarization kind of lies at the center of, continues to be at the center of American politics. And the question for the Biden administration is whether they can forge enough solidarity across these divided racial lines to preserve its electoral position.
Carsten, any more questions?
There is one. I ask it. It's a direct follow-up almost to what your last sentence was, but I leave it then to you, Raimund, if it fits into your further interview. It is whether or not contemporary cultural cleavages can be overcome by what you call politics of habitation, and what would be the first steps? So we just finished a 2.5-hour-long seminar on this, so it would probably be beyond the scope of the interview, but this would be the last question from the audience.
Okay, well, essentially, I apologize for repeating myself, but you know, when we talk about the Biden program kind of being, you know, on the scale of the New Deal, the part which makes me nervous is that the reason that the New Deal was ultimately successful was that it wasn't entirely a centralized initiative run out of Washington, but that it had always a strong popular democratic element to it. So, for example, that in response to the Dust Bowl, the loss of topsoil across the prairies and even into the Middle West, that the Roosevelt administration arranged for the creation of soil conservation districts across rural America, and that people elected representatives to these soil conservation districts, so that farmers elected the leadership that developed the plans as to how money would be spent and agricultural practices changed in a direction that would preserve the topsoil and reverse the process that had led to the Dust Bowl. And my argument is that the initiatives that are taken now have to incorporate that kind of bottom-up participation, bottom-up element. And that is the kind of only true path to overcome the polarization and the misunderstanding and the misinformation, because when you engage people at the local level, at the community level, in solving concrete problems, it's only then that you can begin to kind of break through this epistemic divide where, you know, people who get their news from Fox News can't even have a conversation with the people who get their news from MSNBC or a more progressive site.
But it takes much longer, of course. If you can't do things from top to the bottom, but you empower areas of decision on the local level, on the municipal level, It takes much longer, and that has been one of the criticism thoughts. The way the Biden administration has approached this reform, that they bet on two big packages and want to have these two big packages through because they think of the next year and the election of Congress in the midterm elections, and they want to have results And they can't wait for all the small communities to discuss and to find out what to do. Fred, I wanted to ask you about Bernie Sanders, because we have him in the title of our talk. He is a senator from the not so extremely powerful state of Vermont, one of the smaller states. He says he's a democratic socialist, which is pretty unusual in American politics, but he has an important role in the Senate now. He's head of the budget committee, and that is a very powerful committee. And the fact that he gave up his presidential bid and joined Biden, helped Biden to reunify the Democratic Party. So how far can Bernie Sanders today, as a senator, as head of the budget committee, really influence politics in America?
Well, I think he's been doing a great job, but you see the kind of limits of his influence. He basically started out with the $6 trillion bill for over 10 years, and then kind of acknowledged that he was compromising down to $3.5 trillion, and then the sausage making began, and we're now down to $1.8 trillion. So he's getting, if this does go through, 30% of what he started with. But the flip side is, as compared to the last 40 years, getting 30% of the loaf is, a huge transformation. So there's no question that he and I think we also need to emphasize the role of Elizabeth Warren, because she is a senator and as a presidential candidate, put on the agenda the wealth tax in the U.S. and said, if we started to, tax a penny, two pennies on the dollar on the wealth over $100 million, it would generate the kind of funds that could finance this. And that had a very dramatic impact, I think, on the imagination of the Democratic Party, that in the tug of war over the legislation, the wealth tax, a billionaire tax, didn't make it into the final cut. But it's on the agenda, and there are increases in taxation on multimillionaires are part of the package, part of how it's being paid for. And it's also an important part of the package. And this is one where we have to keep our fingers crossed till the very last minute, that there's a lot of money to the Internal Revenue Service to increase their capacity to cut down on tax cheating and the use of tax havens and so forth. We found out from the latest round of disclosures that the scale of the tax avoidance and the use of tax havens, including tax havens in South Dakota, has just grown exponentially, and that the possibilities for any kind of decent social policy requires much stricter enforcement of the tax code.
What is the role of ideology here? Democratic socialism, does that mean anything for in American politics nowadays? We don't only have Bernie Sanders, we have a group of young leftist representatives, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC is sort of the best known of these young activists. They also call themselves socialist. Well, socialism seems to be a concept of the last century, and it has been sometimes successful, but sometimes that has been a catastrophe. What does socialism, so democratic socialism, mean in the political debate in the U.S. nowadays?
Well, my line on this is that the market fundamentalists, the free market people, brought this them on themselves because, you know, in the famous term of Margaret Thatcher, there's no alternative. You know, it's free market capitalism or chaos. I mean, that no other system has worked. And so we can't increase taxes on the wealthy. We can't provide more social services because that would interfere with the core mechanisms of free market capitalism. And that as a consequence, people under 40 and maybe even now people under 50 in the US say, well, if that's the only thing on offer, you know, if, you know, then I'm a socialist. I mean, because, you know, this set of arrangements where, you know, we go to college and we end up college, you know, with $200,000, $300,000 of student debt, and we spend the rest of our, you know, if we're able to find any kind of decent employment, you know, a good chunk of our income goes to pay off these loans. If this is what capitalism is, I want something different. So I see it as you know, a response to the claim that the logic of capitalism closes off all other possibilities. The revival of democratic socialism in the US has played an important role in opening up political space. And, you know, without that revival, without the two campaigns that Bernie Sanders waged for the presidency, the left turn of the Biden administration wouldn't have happened. I mean, that it is that pressure from below that created the awareness of the leadership of the Democratic Party, that continuing with what we might call left neoliberalism wasn't going to work. It's no longer a political strategy that can possibly fend off the authoritarian right.
Fred, I have another question on the political atmosphere in universities, maybe liberal art colleges. We have in Europe on many pages in newspapers, magazines, we have this discussion if in America, coming from the left, there is a new kind of anti-tolerant streak, the so-called woke culture, meaning that there is the freedom of expression is limited at these universities. We have in these articles the description of a culture of cancel culture, people who don't agree with what woke activists think are not allowed to speak, followed on Twitter, are intimidated. And there are examples of a professor recently in the UK and others who gave up after having been criticized and attacked by so-called woke people. So how do you see this playing out? Is this all exaggerated? Is this description exaggerated that we have a restriction of freedom and of tolerance coming from radical people of the left, the so-called woke culture? Does that, or are these fringe developments?
I guess I want to come down kind of in the middle and say that it is a real issue, but one has to understand the larger context in which it emerges. So, you know, we you began by talking about the social movement in response to George Floyd's death. And the striking thing about that movement was that, you know, while it, you know, helped, it might have helped in the election of Joe Biden in terms of the mobilization of more voters at the grassroots, that the achievements of that movement of Black Lives Matter have been extremely limited to date. In other words, they wanted criminal justice reform. They wanted police to be limited in their use of deadly violence. The federal legislation to do that failed to progress. They wanted voting rights secured, but that a number of Republican-dominated states have further restricted voting rights, created more barriers to voting for minority populations. And kind of in the latest round, they're drawing new district lines for the election of congressional and state legislative positions that even further reduce the voice of minority communities in order to elect more Republicans. So in
This woke thing is there. Yeah.
No, right. Yeah. So, but what I'm saying is that the people who were mobilized in that movement, who were essentially mobilized for racial justice, for racial reckoning, have been unable to affect the larger polity. And so what one gets is this kind of sectarian response where, you can't get the Republicans to be less racist. You can't get the Democrats to push through voting rights legislation. But you can make life miserable for conservatives on your local campus. So it's a kind of outgrowth of a movement that's not able at the moment to win its key objectives. So people turn on each other. They turn on people who might otherwise be allies. So this is going on campuses. It's going on within organizations that are, well-meaning organizations, and leaders are deposed because they weren't racially sensitive enough and so forth. So I think it is exaggerated in the public media. But it does represent a problem, but it is a familiar problem because in the upsurge of popular movements, we almost always see a kind of sectarian fringe to those popular movements where people attack, potential allies are insisting on a rigid set of doctrines, a rigid set of definitions, and so forth. I think there's a fairly strong counter movement. We're seeing kind of more public statements in favor of free expression. So I think that if the political, it will go away under two circumstances, that if the authoritarian right returns to power, it will go away. If the progressive opening, if the Biden administration is successful in pushing through its program and winning back some of those non-college white voters and does reasonably well in the midterms and in the next election, then and the reform movement begins to expand, then I think it'll also go away.
Fred Block, I would like to come back towards the end of our talk to your book, American Capitalism, your book on capitalism. You mentioned in that book, you mentioned that innovations in societies, driving societies, very often come from war situations and are created in warlike confrontations. So today, in the pandemic, we are in a certain way in a warlike situation. Emmanuel Macron, at the beginning of the pandemic, mentioned that quite often, sans en guerre, we are in a war. It was not so popular in Austria and other places when politicians used that metaphor. But of course, there is some truth in it, because to confront the pandemic, you need to mobilize the whole society. To do things, you need to make people do things that they don't like to do, maybe. So I wonder, where does, I mean, can you explain us what you mean that innovations come from war mobilizations, and where do you see that today in today's situation?
Okay, so it's very simple that, you know, going back, you know, into the distant past, that rulers, in order to improve their country's military posture, would essentially collect a bunch of smart people and throw money at them and say, "Develop me some new weapons," and that's how a lot of the innovation in human history happened. A more contemporary example is that, you know, we all know that Fleming discovered penicillin, you know, that the bread mold killed bacteria, but that was in 1923 or something like that. And nobody bothered doing anything with the discovery, because it's really expensive to, you know, turn a mold into a commercial product. And that the way in which it happened was that British scientists who were working on the development of penicillin connected with the U.S. Army, like I think in 1939, and persuaded the military that having antibiotics, you know, when the U.S. entered the Second World War, would be very helpful, because a lot of the casualties in war come from infections resulting from wounds. And the U.S. Army essentially underwrote the process of moving from the discovery that the mold killed bacteria to developing a commercial product, because they were facing the imperative of war. So what follows is that we have the capacity to do this whenever we want, you know, if we consider a threat serious enough. And we did this with COVID, that the very short time between the outbreak of the pandemic and the development of the vaccine, or the multiple vaccines, you know, this was the fastest development of vaccines, you know, in human history. It was a, you know, phenomenal achievement. It was, of course, prefigured by years of government funding of research in mRNA technology, but it was still an extraordinary achievement. And that, you know, the way that I think about it is that we haven't quite, you know, glommed on to the idea that we can innovate productively whenever we want to, If we're willing to collect a bunch of really smart people and throw money at them, and obviously around the challenge of climate change, we clearly need to do that. And, this has been done, at some significant scale over the last 20 years in terms of public funding of climate-related science and technology, but we need to expand that effort even more dramatically because that we can find technological solutions, but bringing them to scale requires also a good deal of collective effort.
And America has the tradition of self-correction, which is a tradition that is stronger in American democracy because of the democratic tradition, because of the acceptance of civil disobedience, of activity from the base, and this capacity of America to self-correct may help us be a little bit optimistic despite the huge political polarization in this country and despite the big discrepancies between what needs to be done and what can be done. Fred Brock, thank you very much for your time and for your insight. Anything important that I missed, that we missed, that you would want to convey to our viewers and our students around the world?
I think we've conveyed the central idea, which is that we're, on a knife edge, and we're likely to be on that knife edge, between a cheerier future and a very dismal future. We're going to be poised on that knife edge for, probably a number, another 3 or 4 years, and it's a dangerous place to be.
On knife's edge of Messers Schneide steht die amerikanische Demokratie, sagt Fred Block, dem amerikanischen Soziologen Fred Block an der Central European University vom 16.11.2021. Bei der CEU bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für das Okay zu dieser Übertragung. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW folgen, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Internationale Reflexionen auf hohem Niveau finden Sie regelmäßig im Falter. Ein Abonnement des Falter ist ideal, wenn Sie informiert sein wollen. Rund um die Feiertage gibt es auch Geschenksabos, mit denen Sie sicher gehen, dass Sie bei den Beschenkten das ganze Jahr in guter Erinnerung sind. Alle Informationen gibt es im Internet über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich. Bis zur nächsten Folge.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.